author of the week with Alex Lefchuk and, of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose.
Haunted Hamilton, Creepy Capital, Time's Terror, Evasion, just a small smattering of some of the awesome books of our next guest. And that's before we can even get into his work in the publishing industry, where he's referred to very much as Mark from Kobo. Marvelous. We are, of course, talking about the fabulously talented, amazingly wonderful Mark Lefebvre. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing great, Alex. Great to see you.
Excellent. And you address a really key aspect of, obviously, the publishing industry. That is the fact that it is an industry, with, of course, your latest text, again, opening up a whole range of areas with respect to that. And I know, as we've just been joined by Gabriella Van Genians, one of our fine journalism students from the University of Lincoln, she'll have lots of questions to put to you about this whole essence of publications, etc. So I'm not going to mess around. I'm on my desert island, as you can see. It's the scenery on radio. It's so much better. Gabriella, would you like to throw some questions to Mark about life, the universe, and what it's like being an author, a professional speaker, a bookseller with more than a quarter century of experience in writing, publishing, and bookselling? He's a one-stop show. Phenomenal.
Hi, Mark. It's nice to meet you. Firstly, I'd just like to ask, kind of, what or who inspired you to become an author?
Oh my God, I'm not sure. If I had to blame anyone, it would probably be Stan Lee. I loved reading the Marvel comic books, Spider-Man, and so many of the stories that he had created. So I think reading those, among so many other things. I mean, I loved comic books. I loved reading. I loved books from a young age, and I wanted to tell my own stories. I was so fascinated by stories. And I was just bit by the storytelling bug early on. So I felt like I always knew I wanted to write. I wanted to be a storyteller in some way, shape, or form.
I mean, that sort of connection of wanting to write, it is a classic line. I mean, we often get people saying, how do I become a writer? And the response is, well, you write. I mean, is it literally, it's a bit like the rest of us non-writers would probably turn around and say, well, just as we have to breathe each day, certainly a writer has to write each day. Otherwise, frankly, the whole experience is pointless.
Honestly, that's what it is. Because even if I'm not writing, the creative writer in me is constantly absorbing and picking up on things, whether it's, well, pre-COVID, pre-pandemic, you know, in a crowded cafe, when you see something, you make a note of it, or anything you experience. Often it comes from, in many, many cases, which is probably why I write speculative fiction, mostly is the what if question. Well, what if, you know, aliens did land? Or what if that dark shadowy thing that I thought I saw in the middle of the night was a monster, or any of those things. Obviously, what if doesn't have to be scary or speculative, but it often is, at least in my twisted imagination.
And of course, what if has always had a long history, long before the Disney Plus Marvel Universe started using what if as a way of actually branding their latest series of what if. It's just a matter of course, really. But I know that Disney lawyers are very keen on this kind of thing. Yeah. So I just wanted to make sure that it was sort of separated from that. I don't think they've copyrighted what if as yet, but you never know. They might trademark it as we're speaking. Let's move on to the seven P's of publishing success. Killing It on Kobo, and an author's guide to working with libraries and bookstores. That's before we even come to the notion of Wide for the Win, which, in the words of Linda Shenton Matchett, the book is everything she expected and more, written in a conversational tone. The book can be consumed cover to cover or by subject matter topic. There is a wealth of information inside, some of which validates what she figured out on her own, but all of which will be helpful as she makes her way along the wide journey. Wide for the Win, of course. And what you've done here, it would seem, is a one-stop shop guide to that other aspect, because we've talked about the importance of writing and doing and needing to write. But sometimes, maybe I'm way off base here, I think authors like to have their work read as well and accessed and so on. And maybe make a living out of it as well. I know it's shocking, radical thoughts here, particularly when we've got creative writing courses, universities and campus across the base. But you really do seem to have kind of cracked that egg here by addressing something which a lot of authors have been moaning about, because you talked about the pandemic, we talked about book signings. What we're doing now is a classic case of getting the brand out there. Share with us, what was the mission, the Lefebvre mission in terms of actually getting this whole essence of how to actually get your product out there?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, one of the great things is the digital publishing era really removed some of the gatekeepers for publishing, right? You didn't have to wait for permission for somebody from London or New York or Toronto, if you happen to be Canadian, to decide that your book is good enough. And then they had to pitch it to a bookstore to sell it based on a four-season selling cycle. So digital publishing gave authors the power to be able to, be authorpreneurs, to take that writing and publishing the business aspects into their own hands. But what we didn't do when the industry made that available is didn't necessarily point authors in the direction of understanding what being a business person is and understanding the business of writing and publishing. So what I tried to do with all of these books in the Stark Publishing Solutions series is take my more than 30 years of experience in the industry, having worked as a bookseller, having grown up in traditional publishing, worked with traditional publishers, and actually editing anthologies myself as an acquiring editor, as well as self-publishing. So all of these different aspects and reminded authors of, regardless of which path you choose, and ideally you may want to choose a little bit from each. It's like a buffet. It's not a, you can only pick one thing off the menu, right? You can go back and select different things and different helpings. It's just really understand those business aspects and understand that, yes, we're passionate about storytelling. We're passionate about the books we write, but our books are a commodity. They're a product. And the way that bookstores and libraries see them, I mean, they love them too. They're in the industry because of their passion for books. But that book needs to pay its rent on a bookstore shelf. And a publisher acquires a book because they see it as an investment where they invest a whole bunch of money up front and they want to make that money back. And so when you pitch to a publisher or you're pitching to a bookstore or library, or even if you're pitching your book or even, you know, the elevator pitch when someone says, so what's your book about? Instead of saying, well, it's too complicated and I'm so smart and nobody else understands all the cool things I put together. Yes, of course, your book is unique, but we've got to kind of dumb it down to a simple log line. Like, well, this is, and I'll use an example from Stowaway, one of my Canadian werewolf novel adventures. It's like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles meets Logan, right? What I've done is simplified it to something that you can understand. Oh, okay, it's a misadventure with some humor in it. And it's probably an adult who has some super abilities, more like a wolf, who is trying to take care of a younger child on a road trip. So you kind of see that mashup. And I think understanding some of those things makes it easier for authors to sell more, because they're not just writing the best book they can. They're not just working with the best editors and publishers or designers they can, but they're also finessing their business acumen, which I think is an often overlooked aspect of the industry.
Self-publishing has had a mixed reception over the last few decades. I think you mentioned the electronic revolution, and that's certainly impacting on people's styles and so on. Do you find that your own experience as an editor also helps to hone your inner bovine stuff detector? Because believe me, looking at the negative side of things, Mark, there are some, for instance, obviously present company accepted, some student essays that I've seen, which you honestly think, have you even thought of using spell check on this one in terms of just the style in which it's developed? I mean, are there ever times when you just think, wow, you know, where are we going for this? Or effectively, you know, the concept might be great, but the actual delivery and execution is woeful.
Well, I think what happened with the digital revolution is the slush pile moved from the publisher's back room. And the slush pile is what the industry calls unsolicited manuscripts that get piled. And there's actually piles and piles. And if you've ever been in a publisher's,
you can be buried alive, Mark, under certain slush piles. It's amazing.
Yeah. But the slush piles move from the publisher's back room to an online catalog near you. And that's where the authors who really understand the business aspect and understand that if you take over as the publisher, you are responsible for editing. You're responsible for solid cover design that's on par with the target audience you're seeking, with the genre, et cetera. Not just a good cover, not just great art, but something that's on brand for the expectation of the reader based on genre. So a great cover for a science fiction novel is not going to be the same as a great cover for a literary novel. is not going to be the same as a great cover for a cozy mystery or an erotic romance or whatever. They all have different aspects. So understanding that, but then understanding, the intellectual nature of international pricing, you know, that in London, for example, pricing in GBP needs to be very on par with what the traditional publishers are doing, which is very aggressive. And they're actually pricing at a far more reasonable rate than the publishers in North America that are overpricing their ebooks, for example. And then even understanding the sales blurb and the copy and all of those elements. So I think it's now there's a little bit more onus on the reader. And that's where, when you look at statistics from the industry, is people, I mean, let's be honest, people don't walk into a bookstore or go online and say, I'm going to look for the latest book by HarperCollins or Penguin Random House. They say, I'm going to look for the latest book by Michael Connelly or Margaret Atwood or
Mark Lefebvre.
Think of some independent authors, Hugh Howey or Bella Andre or any of those, authors that they may like.
They're looking for the latest book from Mark Lefebvre. That's what I like to say. You know, you go for that. Yeah. That's what you scan for.
Exactly.
We'll turn to Gabriella, but I mean, clearly judging a book by its cover is critical. I mean, we have a regular feature called Book of the Month. The current edition was actually Jen, which was actually a Border Collie's tale written by Peter Kerr, self-published. As you can see, I'm actually holding the physical copy in my hand. But like everybody else, I am tempted to use the traditional or perhaps the growing line of portable devices to download, read text, etc. And yes, Jeff Bezos's former company, now that he's left to go into space, is one of those things which has had mixed reviews. I mean, some people will say, Jeff, you're strangling the author, you're ripping them off in so many ways. Others would say it's a lifesaver. What are your views on you know, a big player like Amazon?
Well, Amazon was instrumental in helping to change the landscape. So, for example, I grew up in a small town that didn't have a bookstore. It was an hour drive to get to the nearest bookstore. You know, growing up in a place like that, and even the library was closed because it was connected to the school for 2 months over the summer. And being a big book nerd, I'd have to check it, and you could only check out 14 books at a time, and that wasn't going to last me.
That's a day.
So the ability to be able to to ship books. Or, you know, with a device like a Kindle or a Kobo or a Nook or any of these e-reading devices, is I don't have to wait for a physical product to arrive. I can start reading it within 5 minutes. And there's great library apps as well that allow the BorrowBox and OverDrive and all of these platforms that allow distribution into the library market. The other thing that I think is, I mean, I got into self-publishing early on. Some of my originally short stories I'd sold to small press markets, I ended up recollecting them into a book in 2004. Now, you know, the Kindle didn't exist, so there was no easy way to get an ebook out there. I had to go, and I used print on demand at least. So at least I didn't have to print 1,000 copies to keep in my trunk or in my basement. So I used print on demand. But when the Kindle and the iPad and the Nook and the Kobo and all of these platforms came out, that also removed a huge cost barrier for authors. So that instead of having to focus on having to print 1,000 copies and have to have all that money to do it up front, they were able to, you know, focus their money on the editorial and design and those important aspects to make it the best book they could. So I think I love what Amazon did for the industry. I am leery of Amazon's push for exclusivity. And that's the thing I caution authors about, because if you do go exclusive to Amazon, that can give you some perks. And they are the world's biggest bookstore, but there's going to be plenty of markets around the world your book will not be available in. I only read on Kobo ebooks. I mean, I read physical books, but when I read ebooks, I read Kobo. So if you're not available on Kobo, I'm not going to get your books. You're guaranteed 100% of the people on the other platforms are not going to be able to get your books. And so I'm always leery about anyone who has too much of a monopoly or too much of a dominance. And I would love to see all of the platforms. I'd love to see Apple and Kobo and Nook, which is, again, only available in the US. They used to be in the UK. But any of those other platforms, Google Play, for example, and there's dozens of other smaller platforms. I want to see them all prosper, because when they all prosper, we have a balanced playing field and authors are not solely dependent on a single retailer, to control their fate and destiny.
You mentioned Nook there. I often thought that we could actually have a relaunch of Nook, but actually call it Cranny, perhaps. You know, so you'd have Nook and then you could have Cranny. Just a thought. Maybe it's something you like to take up, Mark, from that thing, as Mark from Kobo. Gabriella, as an avid reader and consumer of books and text yourself, what are your views on this distribution thing and the lines that Mark's been saying there about where you've been going? I mean, again, I've got to say, I am guilty of using Amazon as opposed to the other things that actually we mentioned there. I must switch to Kobo, clearly. Or should I go for both? What are your thoughts on this, Gabriella?
Well, I think it's like really interesting what Mark was saying. I think actually, you know, during COVID, I mean, particularly where I live in like the small countryside, sort of middle of nowhere, but lots of people have been going to like actual their local bookstores now because of COVID, because, you know, I think it's kind of taught people, oh, you know, like local bookstores, they should be supported and stuff like that. I'm quite a traditional paperback girl, to be honest. Not going to lie, to me, there's nothing just like opening up a paper book. And I was just going to ask Mark as well, what are your opinions on, because there's a lot of debate between like audiobooks and the traditional paperback books, because I'm actually quite a big fan as well of audiobooks. Do you have like a favorite audiobook and sort of what are your opinions on them?
Yeah, so I mean, when I worked at Kobo, we found one stat that was interesting, is that people who read ebooks bought twice as many print books as they used to buy before they started reading ebooks, because they consumed more, it was quicker, it was cheaper. And then they wanted the nice tactile feel. Like you can see there's books behind me. We have almost every room in the house has bookshelves in it because that's how many books we have. We can build a Christmas tree out of books out every year, which we do. And we still have stacks and stacks of bookshelves that are still filled. I do love my print books, and I will often read a book in print, maybe so I can mark it up, especially if it's a nonfiction book where I'm learning, or I want a signed copy. An entire shelf over there is just nothing but signed copies over my 30 years of working in bookselling. Research that I do often, I want a print copy. So for example, I had Hitler's Monsters, which is an academic, looking back at some of the supernatural things they were trying to do in the Third Reich. And I listened to the audiobook. It was like an 18-hour audiobook, and it's this giant 800-page book. But I had the print book as well, so I could highlight it because I was using it for research. I love audiobooks because I'm going to be going on a road trip today. And I am going to be on the road for 6 hours. And so I downloaded to my Kobo app on my... And I have both an Audible and a Kobo, and I also have Overdrive library system, like Libby. So I probably have about 5 different ways to get audiobooks onto my phone. And I'll be in the car by myself, so I'll be listening to audiobooks. I listen to audiobooks on a run. When I did an ultra marathon, you know, it was great. I listened to an entire book during that marathon. So the only worry is you run out of battery. But I think there have been arguments, even my partner and I, in the early days. She's now an audiobook fan like I am. But in the early days, she said, well, that's not reading. And I said, okay, so when you, how is it not reading? Because when I look at a piece of paper, I'm interpreting words and I'm imagining that in my mind. If somebody's reading it to me, I am interpreting those words and imagining it in my mind. So I actually I've been able to read more because I'm a slow reader with audiobooks. And I also listen to most books at 1.5 or 2 speed, depending on how slow the narrator reads.
It's a fascinating line, Mark, because a similar argument is said about radio. I mean, back in the day, pre-2000, indeed pre-pandemic, Gabriella would have been with me in the radio studio at Siren Radio. You would have been connecting via the telephone, that wonderful device. We would have phoned you up. We would have gone live. This thing would have been there. People are still listening to this on Siren Radio, but obviously many more people will have downloaded it from our Podbean site, southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. People would also be wanting to find out more of Gabriella. They'll download her particular excerpt from the platform on Spotify that close to you is actually to be found on. See the way I slipped in a shameless plug for you there, Gabriella, just effectively put together. And obviously there are other areas in which you have that range of, there are folks who say, but it's not radio. If you're not listening to it on a transistor radio, it's not radio. And yet actually the audio experience, it's just been translated to different media forms.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%. It's kind of like a good friend of mine, Kevin J. Anderson, who's a science fiction writer. He
X-Files would not be the same without Kevin J. Anderson's texts.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, he's written in almost every universe and hundreds of books out there. But he used to say, well, you know, when you think about music, what is the real music? Is it the band playing live? Is it the vinyl pressing of the recording that was done? Is it the cassette tape? Is it the CD? Is it the MP3 file on your computer? What's the real song? It's the same sort of thing. It's like the real song is the experience that the consumer has in their heart, in my mind, in their mind, in their heart. You know, that's in their imagination. That's the real experience right there.
Just for the benefit of our younger listener, and indeed possibly Gabriella, a cassette tape is something you can see in Guardians of the Galaxy. Okay, it was used there. That's a cassette tape. It's not to be confused with a videotape, which is one of these little devices. That's a sort of another thing, which again, you probably say, what strange object
looks
is
like
this that he's actually holding
sort.
Up? It's important, you know, built-in obsolescence, we head up there. At least the book is in good form. Let's return to Wide for the Win. Is that a deliberate reference to wing play, American football? I mean, it's obviously subtitled Strategies to Sell Globally via Multiple Platforms and Forge Your Own Path to Success. Why did you go for Wide for the Win?
Well, I have a history of alliteration. So a lot of my traditionally published nonfiction, true ghost story tales or tales told as true, or haunted hospitals, tomes of terror,
creepy capital,
prison libraries, you know, spooky Sudbury, creepy capital. So I liked alliteration. And I did Killing It on Kobo with that similar brand. But so wide is a term that independent authors or self-published authors have been using for several years to denote exclusivity to Amazon and Kindle Direct Publishing, which they have an option to be select, which means it's only the ebook will only be on Amazon, or publishing wide, which means also being on Apple and Google and Kobo and Nook and Tolino and a whole bunch of other platforms. And so that's the exclusivity versus wide argument. So Aaron Wright, who is a very successful romance author, had read Killing It on Kobo and contacted me and said, oh my God, I want to help authors be successful everywhere. And I'm going to write a book called Wide for the Win. So she started a Facebook group called Wide for the Win. And I said, oh, this is awesome. I'll you know, write the introduction for you. Let me know how I can help. This is so awesome. She created this group. It's now, I think it's over 9,000 people strong. And then she spent 2 years researching the book. And ironically, all the work she was doing in Wide for the Win was taken away from her romance novels, and her fans were getting upset because they, you know, they wanted more books from her. So she reached out and said, well, I don't think I'm going to be able to do it because I've been working on this book for 2 years and it's never done. And so I said, well, can I take over the writing of the book? And can I use the name? Because I kind of like it. It kind of fits in brand with what I've been doing. And so that the whole idea. Now, my version of Wide goes even beyond the average independent author who's just thinking, you know, Amazon ebooks versus ebooks everywhere else. My version of Wide is, okay, it's not just that. It's other formats. It's print. It's hardcover. It's large print. It's audiobook. It's, I have sold Twitter stories. I have stories available on different platforms. I have VoiceMap, which is a free app you can download to your phone. I have virtual ghost walk tours based on research I did for, you know, books I've sold to publishers that you can go and listen to me walk you through downtown Hamilton on a virtual ghost walk where you're actually GPS enabled. So my version of Wide goes way beyond just that. My version of Wide is working with publishers and deciding, you know, like Kevin J. Anderson, I'm going to sell the rights to this book to this publisher. I'm going to sell the rights to this other book to this other publisher. I'm going to self-publish this one. And all of the options. So for me, it's embracing the wide opportunities and the wide possibilities to have a long-term career as an author. And regardless of what technology comes along, you don't go, oh no, Gutenberg's press, I can't do scrolls anymore, right? Like you're not worried about that. You are embracing the new opportunities as they come.
Let's face it, Johannes Gutenberg was a failed medical salesman. He basically used to sell medical cures before he realized there was no future in that, and had several failed businesses before he actually sort of set up his printing. bless him. The Chinese might have said they got there beforehand, but let's not talk about them in this particular area.
Yeah, let's not go there. We'll just go with the standard.
I mean, one of the things I get from Mark is the dynamism, the enthusiasm, which is fantastic. Is the future intrinsically good for individual authors? I mean, you get folk who will actually inevitably say, but the glass is half empty. What about? Are those self barriers that are actually there, in essence, literally self-imposed? And do we now look for publishers, writers of whatever age or generation they happen to be, whether they're in their teenage years, whether they're in their 80s or 90s or whatever, that actually there's still a way of getting their book out there with that dreadful scenario of saying, well, thank you very much for your submission, but frankly, it's rubbish.
This is where the first book that I wrote for authors called The 7 P's of Publishing Success comes in. I would often tell writers, regardless of which path you choose, traditional publishing, indie self-publishing, or some combination, some hybrid adaptation, the three of the P's of publishing success, long-term publishing success, are patience, practice, and persistence. Meaning you got to keep writing, you got to keep learning, you got to keep getting better at the craft. You can't give up. Most people dream that I would like to write a book one day. Most people will never write a book one day. So that's one thing. If you've actually written a book, you're in the 1%. And then the authors who are successful in either traditional publishing or self-publishing, they don't give up. J.K. Rowling couldn't originally sell her book about this little boy who lived under the stairs with a scar on his head who happened to have
never
going to
work.
Yeah, I mean, Bella Andre, probably one of the first international success stories for her self-published romance, was traditionally published and had a publisher say, no one wants to read about this Sullivan family that you want to write about. So she's like, well, I'm going to try self-publishing it. And, you know, cracked 7 figures within the first 2 years of publishing that series. Now I think she's on like book 24 in that series. So there's so many stories. John Grisham couldn't sell Time to Kill, I think, was originally self-published, as I understand it. And he worked really, really hard before it got picked up by a major publisher. So there's so many stories of success. But now the paths for success are not limited to, you know, 3 major centers, maybe Frankfurt, London, and New York, Toronto, places like that. They're not limited to those centers for English language publishing. There are more opportunities available. So I think authors can get discovered, can build an audience through so many different platforms. And they're not just dependent upon, okay, somebody printed my book and put it in a bookstore somewhere.
Indeed. You mentioned A Time to Kill because it was literally a matter of hours ago that we were focusing on a fine soul who actually worked on the movie of A Time to Kill. And again, just sort of demonstrates the way in which works through Anna Elias, who has recently published The Vessels, which is great stuff. Gabriella, any closing thoughts or questions you'd like to put to Mark?
Yes, so I would just love to ask, kind of, what advice do you have, particularly for young writers that are just starting now to get into the industry? What advice do you have for them?
Oh, great question, Gabriella. Thank you. I would advise, there's so much information out there, and it can be like a fire hose of information. One of the things I love about the writing and publishing community is the collaboration and the willingness of writers, whether they're traditionally published or self-published, the willingness for them, because they understand what it's like. They remember what it's like. I remember what it's like to want to write, to want to learn, to want to grow. And most are so willing to give you time and help you and answer questions. So whether it's through your local school, there's mentorship programs I've done through the university I graduated in, where I'm willing to have writers coming through the program, call me and ask for questions. I offer a free 20-minute consultation on my website, marklesley.ca, for writers who just have questions. Hey, just 20 minutes. You want to chat? Okay, go for it. Because I remember having questions and wanting to learn and not having access. Now you can go online and join groups like Wide for the Win on Facebook, or there's YouTube videos with help and support. Authors sharing their frustrations and joys on TikTok and all the different media. Finding some communities that you're comfortable with, that you feel like these are my people. They understand the kind of things I'm passionate about writing. And usually if you ask, take the time to ask, people will be willing to help you. And just remember, people are going to tell you things. They're going to say, oh, you have to do it this way. And you have to, even myself, oh, you should do it this way. You should do it that way. You take that information. And this is what usually you learn in higher education is okay, I'm going to be critical thinking. I'm going to absorb, and I'm going to apply a little bit of a proverbial grain of salt. And I'm going to adapt that advice or that information or that experience that was shared with me into my own journey and make it work for me. And I think that's really important. And it's okay to pause and take the time to digest it and ask more questions. So hopefully that's somewhat useful to you.
It's opened up a whole new area. Mark, we know that the taxi is waiting to whisk you away to another sort of exciting scenario. But I just want to actually finish with a couple of sort of final things. First of all, have we managed to pronounce Lefebvre correctly?
You add such a flair to it, Alex. I usually tell people it's Lefebvre, as if it was spelled L-E-F-A-V-E.
Oh.
But I like the flair that you add to it. It makes it sound so exotic and exciting.
Well, I just thought, Mark from Kobo, I know that's the official line. We wanted to go beyond that, move a step away from that. It's very important. It's a bit like when we say Gabriella Van Genians. We need that kind of exoticism coming across. It's very important. So leads on to the final two things, apart from saying, of course, marklesley.ca is, would you suggest, the go-to website to find out further details about what we've been chatting about today?
Yeah, anything you want to know about me and probably things you don't want to know about me are all available there.
I'm interested in the Christmas tree made out of books. I mean, presumably you don't destroy the books at the end of it. I mean, that's a whole new field, really. We must investigate that further.
It is, yeah. It is a really great experience. And my partner, Liz, who can build houses, she's really talented. It's a project she likes to take over on. And we do the different size books. We build it up. We end up using some cardboard as well, like to prop things up. And it goes, starts with the big hardcovers and it moves its way up all the way to the mass market, smaller paperbacks. And then we use electronic tea lights. Different colors, and we have it in the front window, and it's usually he's like, yeah, that's the book nerd house.
So you're not actually just cutting trees down to actually make books, you're then using the books to make a tree. It's totally sustainable.
Recycled, yeah. But you know what the frustrating thing about it is, because we usually start in early December, is sometimes we've put a book in the tree and I haven't read it yet, or I want to go back and reread it. And I was like, oh, I got to wait until January. Maybe I'll get the audiobook.
Yeah. Well, leads us to the two final questions. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been okay for you?
It's been a great experience. Thank you so much.
That's okay. We had a slight slippage in the time zones, but we got there in the end, so that's important. So the next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the very near future? Will you return?
I would love to. You guys are so delightful to chat to. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
You got somebody standing.
We've just heard the awesome number there from Kalia, of course, when you got somebody. And obviously, as promised, we can now, in terms of our Author of the Week session, introduce the creator and indeed songstress behind that, of course, herself. Kalia, welcome to the Midweek Drive. How are you?
Hi there. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Excellent. Now, as I say, we've just heard this tremendous little pop scenario, a little sneak preview, because it's released on September the 10th. Would you like to just share with us the backstory behind the thing and why it's a very important sort of connection that you've put together, musically speaking?
It's like when you have that special someone that you can go to in like times of need, or when you just like are feeling not that, you know what I mean? It's like you're not feeling happy and you're kind of like really sad, or you need someone to like lift you up.
Absolutely. And when you got somebody expresses that perfectly. Now, you're based in Manchester. Got to ask the standard question, City or United or neither?
Neither.
Oh, okay, that's fair enough. So not worried about Cristiano Ronaldo or indeed Pep Guardiola, which is fine. But talk us through your own musical background in terms of why you've decided to obviously explore this. And this is, of course, your first single, and it's a very impressive sort of debut. So is it something you've always wanted to do, or is it just a case of, no, I wanted to do one, then after that I'm going to retire?
It's sort of like a passion of mine, and it has been for like quite a long time. So when I was like three or four years old, I was doing a dance school show, and there was a couple of girls that did solos on the stage. And at the end of it, I asked my parents why they got to sing and I didn't. And they told me that they had singing lessons. So then from like the age of four, I started having singing lessons. And then it's only in the past couple of years that I've started releasing my own music.
Got it. Now, not sure whether you know, but Kalia is actually the 54,196th most popular name of all time. So it's interesting about that, maybe. But is it Kalia or Kalia? Just share with us. What's the pronunciation?
It's Kalia.
It's Kalia. There we are. So Kalia. Well, fine from that point of view. And what are your musical influences, Kalia? I mean, just share with us who kind of particularly sort of floats your boat. I mean, are you more into rock, heavy metal? Are you into pop? What's the kind of area?
Well, I'd probably say like the people that I aspire, like the people that inspire me, are probably like Adele, Olivia Rodrigo, like most of the big names.
Yeah, okay, so that's a lump of that, and nothing wrong with actually following a little bit of Adele from that point of view. We've heard this week, of course, that Kanye has actually put in a bid to change his name to actually formally be referred to as Ye. So, I mean, will you be actually looking to change your name to become Ia or something in years to come?
No, yeah, there's only one Kalia, so can't change my name, can I?
Very true, very true. Yeah, I think Kanye obviously needs to rethink that. Or maybe he already has. How can people actually get in touch with you, Kalia? I mean, in terms of obviously the socials, but I mean, obviously we're doing this interview for Southside Broadcasting. It's following our Author of the Week feature. We've heard it once. We might squeeze in another play before too long. But if people actually want to sort of keep up to date with Kalia and where you're going to be sort of found from that point of view to sort of build up to this very exciting day, the 10th of September, how can they actually get in touch with you?
Well, there is my Instagram is Kalia with dots in between each letter. So it's Kallea, but there's dots in between. And then my YouTube is just Kallea. So you can just type that in and it'll come up. And my Facebook is Kalia McKee Music.
Okay. And you're clearly very young from that point of view. Can we sort of just ask how old you actually are, Kalia?
I'm 11.
Wow, that is astonishing. I mean, I honestly thought from the vocals and the lines from that point of view, I thought you were late teens, but this is 11 years of age. So is this the start of obviously a huge entry for yourself into the world of music?
Yeah, I hope so. Fingers crossed.
Okay. And how has the interviews been going? How have the interviews been going? Because obviously we received this obviously from your mummager. Love that. Stacey McKee, mummager. Great stuff. Stacey sent this line to us. So from your own point of view, Kalia, how have the media been following you? I mean, have you been signed up for BBC Radio Manchester as yet? Are other sort of people battering at your door?
Not yet, but like...
It's only started. Yeah, you don't know what's looking. Going to happen. It's extraordinary. It could open up in a whole range of other bits and pieces there. So, you know, you wrote this and you performed it. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what else do you have in mind? I mean, have you got an album sorted out as yet? Are you sort of, or is it a case of you'll see how this goes and then take it from there?
I'm not working on an album. It's mostly just singles, but... I've also got another single that I'm releasing in October called Better Without You.
Okay. Now we know in a week or so's time, you're back to school and all other bits and pieces from that point of view. In Manchester, is it a case of situation back to normal again, or is it a case of you're still going to actually just take it day by day in terms of the pandemic?
I don't actually know.
Best way, really. So great stuff. And what about the notions of Zoom? I mean, we're doing a Zoom piece today. Have you actually sort of done any live performances with respect to Zoom as yet? Or is that something we can look forward to in the future?
I haven't done any on Zoom, but like over the lockdown, because I couldn't perform live in front of people, I started going on like Facebook Lives and doing some Instagram ones as well.
Well, it's been pretty awesome connecting with a good self. I know that some of my other students who sadly weren't able to actually join us will be very impressed, as they have been, in fact, with respect to the life of that. What's the furthest you've actually reached so far? I mean, have you had any sort of call from, Australia or the China, et cetera? Has anybody else sort of reached you, or are you just opening it up from that point of view?
There's people in Australia, and then I've got quite a lot of fans in America. So,
excellent. Well, I'm going to actually sort of award you the role of music producer to wrap up this particular sequence, etc., because we are going to have another listen to When You Got Somebody, which is great, because you actually also say when you don't have anybody, you should get somebody. That's all the lyrics of the song. It's very good. That's wonderful. So would you like to, again, give a shout out for fans of Kalia, introduce yourself with this particular number, of course, When You Got Somebody. The microphone and floor is yours, Kalia.
Hi everyone, I'm Kalia, and this is my song, When You Got Somebody.
There are days when I don't want to get up, but I keep going 'cause of you. Hearing thoughts telling me I should give up, but you won't let me lose. And I owe all my good times to you. When you got somebody standing beside you, holding your head up, feels like you got it all. When you got somebody, there's nothing you can't do. When you got that love, I believe I can find a way to always set me free. Help me see who I am.
Wet Wood. You may not have actually heard of it. You may have actually sort of considered it to be something that occurs when it's been raining, as opposed to dry wood and so on. But it is actually particularly significant as we consider Chimney Fire Safety Week and what happens if you are using such areas as well to actually keep yourself warm and so on. Wet wood is actually illegal now, primarily because of the harmful toxins it releases, which can damage our lungs. Now, to talk about this and more, we're delighted to welcome the Chief Executive Officer of the not-for-profit Solid Fuel Safety Standards Organisation, which is HETS. Bruce Allen, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Yeah, thanks, Alex. It's good to be here and thanks for having me on board.
So wet wood, again, there are people who probably don't understand what it actually is. Otherwise, they think it's just damp and so on. Talk to us about what it is and why it's obviously now illegal to actually use in any sort of fireplace situation you've got at home.
Okay, so if we imagine that a tree is felled or freshly felled and it's a green, you know, it's a tree that was alive, the moisture content or the water within that tree can be up to 60% of the weight of the tree. So, I mean, that's a huge amount of water.
It's all those xylem vessels, Bruce. That's what it is, all the xylem carrying water.
Yeah. But indeed, that's the bit that we're worried about, because if you try to burn wet wood, then it just creates lots of smoke and lots of particles and creosotes and oils and things. And it's all very unpleasant, both for the chimney and for the environment. And yet if we burn dry wood, which is wood which is 20% moisture content or less, then you get something like a fifth or 20% of the particulate emissions or smoke from burning dry wood, which is a massive, massive benefit. And not only is it a benefit to safety in as much as it doesn't clog up the chimney and cause chimney fires, it's also an economic benefit because it makes the appliance run much more effectively if it's dry, and therefore you get better efficiency and better heat for your pound. And it also reduces particulates, as I say, massively. And a modern fire with the right fuel on it, the right dry fuel, can reduce particulate emissions by 80 or 90%. When considered against an old open fire, say burning wet wood.
Makes perfect sense. Why then have we got a survey which suggests that one in five households are still burning wet wood on a regular basis? Do they not understand? Is it just a case of they've given up on life? What's the situation?
I think this is where we're really grateful to you guys for letting us come on board and talk about it. It's not something that's well known. I mean, wood burning sort of has disappeared in many respects from people's lives and now come back. So since 2014, there's been quite a resurgence in this type of appliance and biomass and wood burning and smokeless fuel burning. We've got smoke control areas. And I think what we're trying to do is say that there's probably 2 million homes in the UK that burn solid fuel as a form of heat, so wood or sort of mineral fuels. And then the other households are those who are burning barbecues and fire pits and things. And the simple message we want to get over is, if you can change one thing, just buy ready-to-burn wood. It's simple. When you get to the shop or the retailer or the merchant, you see the round logo, which is an orange logo with a red flame, and it simply says on it in white writing, ready-to-burn. And that simply says that when you take that home, unlike the net of logs that you got from the garage years ago, then when you take this wood home or this fuel home, it's ready to burn now, whereas the wet wood would have needed a year's seasoning or 2 years seasoning before you could have used it.
Now, this week is Chimney Fire Safety Week, of course. I do still have a smokeless fuel coal fire, which I haven't actually used actually since the turn of the millennium. It's literally the case of it just hasn't been used at all, and I've got no intention of using it at this particular stage. But it is important to obviously ensure that health and indeed our homes are kept safe. Because, I mean, I was astonished to find there are over 3,000 chimney fires between April 2020 and March 2021. That's an awful lot of chimney fires, given that I think most of us sort of tend to think, well, you know, those kind of fuels were on the way out.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue for us is that not everybody gets their chimney swept, you know, when they're using the appliance. I mean, for yourself, it's not so bad, but when people are using an appliance regularly, then they should have it sort of swept twice a year. The chimney sweep, he or she will give great advice and give great service to make sure the chimney is clean and not blocked up by soot, creosote, bird's nests, whatever it might be. So it's important to get the chimney swept. That's the main thing. In terms of the effect of fuel, wet fuel and house coals and things like that create all sorts of chemicals that stick to the side of the chimney and they build up and they can start to catch fire. So this is where the right appliance with the right fuel, swept by a heat ass-approved chimney sweep, you know, then you're going to be safe, effective, efficient, and you're going to be responsibly burning in an environmental sense. That's the message. Very simple thing. Just burn dry wood, buy the ready-to-burn stuff, and you give yourself these three major benefits.
So allowing for regular maintenance of your chimneys, obviously proving that chimney sweeps aren't just for weddings. I suppose that's gone, actually, when a chimney sweep at a wedding was actually there. Are there any other things that people should be doing in terms of actually keeping their homes generally safe if they're still using solid fuel and if, obviously, they still actually want to come home to a real fire and not their home burning down?
Yeah, I think it's make sure that when you're buying your ready-to-burn fuel, you've got somewhere clean and dry to store it. You know, some people don't have much, so they're buying regularly. Some people store quite large volumes, but make sure it's not getting wet. Make sure it's clean. Make sure that, you know, there's not a temptation to put things on that just appear. I mean, we've seen people put Wellington boots and nappies on open fires, and, you know, it's not good because the particulate emissions go up massively. So it's taking a bit of care. It's a bit like your car. I mean, cars, lorries and so on are responsible for the main particulate emissions. So, you know, diesel emissions, petrol emissions, tire wear, brake wear, road wear, they're the major particulate emitters. Solid fuel is not up there with those, but we can play our part, and it is simply by making sure we burn dry wood fuel, smokeless mineral fuels, and do a little bit of maintenance and generally sort of look after each other in terms of responsible burning.
And on average, how often would you suggest ensuring that your chimney is actually maintained? Would it be once every 2 years, once every year, annual basis? What's the sort of frequency?
I think if you're burning wood regularly, twice a year. I mean, I would get a chimney sweep in, a professional chimney sweep, a heat ass approved one. There's a search engine on our website, and you can just look for one that's local, and they will give you advice about burning, and they will give you advice about using the stove and the type of fuel you use, and they will help you to understand what the minimum requirement is, so you're not overspending, but you are still keeping yourself safe, but at least before the burning season, and often twice a year.
And just looking towards HeatAss, the website presumably is the best place to go to for further information on what we've been chatting about today.
Yeah, in terms of HeatAss, there's lots of information at heatass.co.uk. The sister company running the ready-to-burn scheme for wood is woodshaw.co.uk. And the specific website for ready-to-burn is simply readytoburn.org.
And just out of interest, Bruce, HeatAss, is it an acronym which stands for anything, or is it just a case of, well, you want to work through this?
Many years ago, it was the Heating Equipment Testing and Approval Scheme. So we do check out appliances and the test reports on appliances. So we approve appliances, we approve fuels, we approve engineers, so professional engineers, chimney sweeps, retailers. So really, we're trying to give the buying public, if you like, a one-stop shop to come to for all things solid fuel, wood and biomass, to get safety and environmentally responsible burning advice.
And that obviously applies not just to fires, etc., but obviously fire pits, open grates. I mean, more and more people are getting into barbecues and so on, so presumably worth checking those out as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is a different sort of area. So having something installed in your property there's a requirement under building regs for safety and all those sorts of things. But for fire pits and barbecues, it's unregulated. The biggest and best thing you can do is use, you know, smokeless mineral fuels or dry wood. And at least, even though those appliances are not particularly scientific or designed for efficiency or low smoke, you know, at least putting dry wood and the smokeless fuels on them will reduce the particulate emissions greatly, and you can sort of feel a bit better that you're doing something to reduce harmful emissions.
Bruce Allen, Chief Executive Officer of HeatAss. keep on keeping on, and well, happy, safe fireworking.
And thank you very much, Alex, and keep safe.